My name is John Schuster, and I'm the host of Stories for the Ages, a podcast on the ripening and maturing that happens later in life. Our guests come from all over the nation and world, as I find myself on both coasts and a lot of places in between, doing workshops on a variety of topics, including retirement planning workshops, which is one of the initial steps into this third of life that we often call it. This name your fraction, it might be your fourth or your fifth or the second half of life, although I find the topic second half of life or that phrase second half of life a little generous for people in their 60s like I am. Doesn't seem quite honest. These guests will not always agree with themselves, and that's good because one thing we know about aging and maturing is that we all do it so very differently. We all get kind of gloriously idiosyncratic as we get older. We become more of ourselves, and that's one of the great positives of aging is that we can grow into the eccentric and the individual people that we are as opposed to being amalgamated and fitting into the social structures that were important earlier in age to fit into, like the job and the corporation, but which now become less important because we're freed up to be who we are. We'll talk to experts on the aging, maturing, ripening process for midlife adults, anyone who's in one of those second half or third fractions of life. What you can expect here is a free flow exchange of ideas based on particular themes or trends, and I'll outline many of those trends as we go in the field of aging and maturing, because the boomers are not living their parents' retirement. They're making it up themselves. And that's what makes this a pretty exciting time to explore and one that we can look at from many angles. Our next guest is Mike Murray, who is quite the accomplished Austin, Texas native who has spent many years in corporate America helping people with leadership and teams. And he's also a ordained minister who works in church settings as well and community settings. Let's welcome Mike Murray. If I understand right, is this a special day for you?
This actually is my 80th birthday.
Ta-ta, yes, your 80th birthday.
I was born about this time of morning above a bank at a clinic in Del Rio, Texas.
There you go. Well, happy 80th, man. You're starting your ninth decade. Your ninth decade.
Thank you. That's hard to believe.
Yeah. So what are your reflections about life and aging on this auspicious day for you?
Well, this comes at an interesting time, John. In the last Saturday, we attended the funeral of the man who was our best man at our wedding, mm-hmm. my wife and I, and was my college roommate, and got word yesterday of another death of a college friend. So part of being this age is to learn how to appropriately grieve some of the losses that mm-hmm. go on, especially losses of relationships, mm-hmm. which are about as important as anything else in life, or more important than anything else in life. So learning how to appropriately grieve and not stuff it or not become numb to it, become calloused. Mm-hmm. Well, it's another one that you don't, I think that ends up in building up levels of grief that you're not aware of. Uh-huh. So staying aware and conscious that it's time to have another grief moment or mm-hmm. process a grief mm-hmm. Is, I think, one of the important things. There's a lot of other losses that go on. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of gains, too, and I think we're going to have a chance to talk about that.
But, yeah, we're going to talk about both today, but I imagine it's a pretty sobering reminder on your 80th birthday of two losses like that within a week of each other. So, well, that's got to be on your heart. So
exactly.
So since you mentioned that word grieve, let's come back to the positives after a bit. But talk about the grief process for you. Or I will mention to listeners that Mike and I have known each other a long time, and Mike is a man of the cloth. He's an ordained Presbyterian minister, and I've learned much about his faith journey through lots of work with him. He and I also met in the seminar industry and in the people development, leadership development industry, so we did a lot of work together over the last 30 years. And Mike, I've just admired your work, and I would have to say that if I say anything about what you are personally, there'd be many things I could say as a family man and the rest, but I would say your networking skills are extraordinary. I've met more people through Mike's, hey, you ought to meet this guy, and it's been a fabulous way to be invited into this network. So I just tell listeners that because as an ordained minister, I'd like to hear you talking about grief and maybe from a personal point of view and then from a more general point of view, what you've seen others do, what your spiritual tradition might teach us. So
right.
What would you like to say about it, Mike?
Well, certainly the faith tradition does provide some kind of support. It can also provide some really unhelpful ways of trying to take away the emotions that come along with loss and grief. My own personal bias is that we need to be careful in terms of trying to comfort people, thinking that somehow they shouldn't be having the feelings that they're having, or that they should moderate them or not let them be intense. And where that has affected my work, John, as you know, I do a lot of work with churches, but I've also worked a lot in secular settings. And those secular settings are going through enormous amounts of change. And whenever there is change, there is usually loss, which means that the grief process is going to be triggered. And understanding what those, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross came along with a kind of rigid model of that you go through one stage and then you go to the next stage and you go to the next stage. There was a lot of earlier research, Granger Westberg wrote a wonderful book about it, that there are just emotional states that you rotate through, and being aware of those emotional states like anger or fear or feelings of inadequacy or even feelings of guilt, that those will come around. And what's appropriate is to just stay with those and not try to prevent them or think you need to medicate, to make them go away, nor to allow other people to try to remove those emotions from you with some sort of comfort. And then you feel guilty that it's not working or that their efforts aren't working. So simply accepting the fact that there are going to be a whole range of uncomfortable or difficult emotions, but don't think of them as bad. The moment you label those emotions as bad, you're into a whole different way of trying to manage them, and you probably won't manage them effectively or manage them well. Accept them as normal, natural emotions that come when there is any kind of loss. It doesn't have to be the death of a friend. Those are more intense. But it can be changing of procedures or policies or changes in the membership of a team.
Right. Well, Mike, I know Mike best from his work in those secular organizations, basically the free market. He works in companies all the time and has and is a Vistage resource. Vistage is a company for CEOs of small and mid-sized businesses, and he's spoken to them all around the world. So you know the world of business very well, and I think one of the reasons he gets pulled in to speak about it all the time, even at this age 80 where he's still being invited in, is because he knows how to speak about these human events in very very human and understandable ways. You make things very understandable, Mike. You're a great teacher. So talk a little bit more then. Anything else you want to say about grieving before we move to anything else you want to talk about, which will be on the more gifted side of this time of life?
Right. I think that just, again, accepting whatever emotions come as a result. And I think that's part of the aging process, is learning to accept, becoming, if you will, more mindful. That's sort of the end word. And simply allowing whatever is to be, and not trying to to correct it or change it or prevent it or make it go away. That's part of what I work on. Yeah. I think that's the most significant. When you're younger, you want to fix things. You want to change them. You want to make them better. You want to improve them. You want to solve them, and so forth. And some of them, and that's appropriate for a younger age. But I think part of the aging process, part of the upside of aging, is that mindfulness that lets you simply say it is what it is, and it will be what it will be, and learning how to appropriately balance that mindfulness of acceptance with, wait a minute, no, that won't be allowed. That will be addressed. We will fix that. We will change that. That's part of what I think aging can be about. But it takes some work, especially if you've been a fixer all your life, mm-hmm. a rescuer.
Yeah. What I hear in there is the serenity prayer, you know,
yes.
Courage to change what I can, the serenity to know what I can't, and the wisdom to know the difference. So,
the other thing that it takes work, I think. I mean, but in order to enjoy and appreciate the freedoms and the opportunities that come, it's also important to manage expectations of yourself and of other people. And maybe lower those a little bit. Mm-hmm. If you carry too high a set of expectations into the age of 80 for yourself and or your spouse and or other people, as somebody once said, the secret of happiness is lowered expectations.
Right.
So, because when you're constantly, something doesn't measure up, isn't quite the way you expected or needed or thought it should be. Mm-hmm. That's a major source of stress and irritation and upsetness. Mm-hmm. And I that's something I work on a little bit, or have mm-hmm. to work on a little bit, because life is not going to be, well, just watch out for those expectations mm-hmm. and then manage them. And that's what I'm contrasting that to mindfulness, which is just the capacity to look at something and say, it is what it is. Mm-hmm. That's the way it is. Mm-hmm.
Our next guest is Peter Block, who is so well known to people in organizations and leadership development in a field that I was involved in for 40 years and still involved in. Peter's authored many books like Stewardship, like Flawless Consulting, and has sold probably over 1 million books in his career. He's also now working deeply in community work in his city of Cincinnati. Community development, and he's devoted himself to that field the last 20 years. So Peter, I think you told me when I was with you recently, you're 77 now. Is that right?
Yeah. Correct.
Yeah. So I don't know where, maybe start with this question. When did you have wake-up calls that you are no longer a middle-aged man?
Age 70. Yeah, I had glided through my birthdays till then. When I was very young, I wanted to be older. And then once I got my 20s, I just kind of stopped thinking about it. I did have a wake-up call early at age 55. I read in USA Today that my life expectancy was 79. And I thought, 24 to go. Uh-huh. It never didn't seem that big. So I think that rang a bell with me, but it never bothered me. And then when I hit 70, it bothered me a lot. Mm-hmm. Anxious mm-hmm. all the time.
Yeah.
And I thought my future's behind me. You know, and everybody says, oh yeah, some woman 110 just jumped out of an airplane in a parachute and landed on a crossing ground underwater. And I never aspire to live long. Mm-hmm. You know, that doesn't appeal to me. Mm-hmm. Nothing at my age is something I want to prove. And so I got anxious. I felt remorseful. I started experiencing in the early 70s things that had bothered me that I had done. Mm-hmm. And I just couldn't get used to it. Mm-hmm. I'm used to it now.
You are used to it.
Well, it's a shock. It doesn't make me anxious like it did then.
Mm-hmm.
But I just was overcome with a constant 70, 71, 72. I did have a 70th birthday, and that helped a little bit, you know, because I was anxious before I actually had my birthday.
Uh-huh.
But I found it very difficult.
Uh-huh.
And you just kind of wake up to the fact there's certain things you're just not going to do,
mm-hmm.
and you can't.
Mm-hmm.
It's not physical, I just dreams you had. And so that was hard.
Mm-hmm. What sources did you use to sort out things through all that?
I drank a little more than normal. Became more irritable, harder to be with.
Those are great sources.
Yeah, you know, I think somewhere in there I began therapy again.
Mm-hmm.
So Jungian therapy has always been useful for me.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point about 3 or 4 years ago, so maybe 73, 74, I just learned a lot in therapy. I learned a lot that my life had been organized around my work primarily. I wanted to make a difference in the world. I wanted my life to mean something, and that to me wasn't about relationships, it was about work.
Mm-hmm.
Work had gone well. That was always the least source of my anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the big shift for me is I just stopped traveling. I traveled a lot. And I kind of came home. The inspiration for me was Ulysses.
Oh, really?
Where he comes home, you know, reclaims, kills all the suitors for his abandoned wife,
mm-hmm.
with his son. He's home for a while, and he says, well, I took care of that. It's time to go back on the road. And so he's lying in bed one night, and he has a dream, because the next morning he's supposed to go out on a ship and go back and, you know, experience the world. And the dream was to take your oar inland. Don't take it to the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And take it inland and plant your oar in the ground. And that has been a saving image for me. I thought, it's time for me to do that. And so I just stopped all travel except family and one thing I committed to.
Got it.
So that's changed a lot. It's allowed me to find and come back to myself and realize that everything I want to do now is in walking distance and finding some peace within myself.
Got it.
So very difficult.
So you took your oar that had been in the ocean for a lot of decades. From I saw you when you were on that path.
Yeah,
way back.
Actually, it was in the baggage claim on an airplane.
Yeah, yeah. And then you took that image from Ulysses, and he goes back to Ithaca and catches Penelope's life again and decides to stay home.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
they have their bed planted in a tree.
Mm-hmm.
So tree, nature, home.
I think about all these people taking their oars out of the water, but I watch a lot of people. I've interviewed a person already for this experience on Stories for the Ages. It's quite clear that he wants his oars in the water until the end. That's his strategy. You know, just keep on going, keeping on.
Yeah, die with your boots on.
Yeah. I, for some reason, just can't do that, and I'm not tempted to either. It just seems to me like I'd miss out on whatever this surrender is that happens at this stage of life. It is kind of a surrender. It's a different deal.
You know, I'm losing my voice, and there's nothing wrong with my vocal cords. They're just tired.
Mm-hmm.
I've had them examined. I saw them on videotape. And so it's a, I think Kathy, my wife, and God had a conversation. And the answer was, he said enough. That's what they said about Robin Williams when he died, of overdose. And Parker Palmer said he needed a rest.
Yeah, he needed a rest. The big rest. As we go through life, we develop strategies to handle different situations and stages. Let's listen to Peter now talk about what he's done with yoga, and at the same time, how even with good practices like that, there's still difficult parts to the loss and change process of aging. What's yoga doing for you, Peter?
It's good helping me stand up straight, sit up straight, basically. Mm-hmm. Go every day. I only go because it's close and convenient, 5-minute walk. Mm-hmm. So instead of having a dog, I walk to yoga, and it's a refuge. It's a place and a little room, an environment, which allows me to just hold that space. Focus on doing postures. So I find it a sanctuary. And I know if I don't go to a class, I'll do it half-heartedly at home. Mm-hmm. And I like the surrender. You know, I like somebody telling me what to do, mm-hmm. at least for an hour. Mm-hmm. And so I go 7-8 times a week. Ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a practice to me, in the best
That's
sense.
That's as close practice. As I've ever been to a practice. Mm-hmm.
So there's many a theory on aging well and aging consciously, or just aging, period. But one theory is that knowing how to handle loss is huge. And if you can't go with, if you don't know how to grieve, or if you can't go with the flow, you don't have to cooperate with loss, but you at least have to accept it. So, or no, you don't have to, you know, cherish the loss, but you have to somehow cooperate with it. What's your experience been with that side of it?
And I feel I've struggled with loss most of my life. You know, my father died when I was 14, and that was the hardest thing to deal with. And so maybe in some ways, but I've never grieved well. You know, I kind of muscle past it. And I'm probably still doing that a lot. Of course, now people are dying around. So we were at Patrick's funeral. And I said maybe 10 people that I've been close to and known for 20 years are either dead or dying. So it's lonely. Mm-hmm. I'm lonelier because Angela's here and Joel Henning and Patrick Dolan, people like that, are gone. Mm-hmm. Just don't, at my age, I'm not gonna make new friends and have them for 20 years.
Yeah.
And you know, it's harder to make new friends, you know. So I feel a loneliness to it. Mm-hmm. And I do. I miss them from time to time. And then my friends that are sick or older, you know, it's kind of, I don't think I handle it too well. I just, try to learn about it. Mm-hmm. You know? I'm in therapy on and off, but I've been in therapy in my 20s and my 30s and my 40s. So every stage, yeah. You know, you've got to figure out and make some sense of what it constitutes to have a life. This is, but I felt that. And so I really, I'm grateful for a couple of things. One is I don't have a bucket. Mm-hmm. There are things I know I'll never do again, or dreams I might have had of seeing how good a tennis player I could become. And it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I've done enough. You know, I've worked hard enough and been valued enough over the 50 years that I worked that I feel fair enough.
Yeah. Well, most would say you've done more than your share, and that ore was in the baggage claim or in the ocean a lot of decades. So I can see why. Yeah. Part of the process that happens as we age is that attitude shift has to happen. And so the inner dialogue that shifts as we then make more sense out of our experience is not just about relationships or job loss. It can be about our own attitudes that need to change, and there's loss in that as well. In that kind of loss, there's a choice. And so we let go and close the door, and we're free to open a new one.
Once you give up your ambition, and I realized after I get over the stress of not going anywhere, there's a freedom in that. So now I can show up in the world and not want anything from it. Mm-hmm. Now I still have some projects I'm on that activate my Ulysses again. Do it right. Want to be liked. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, even when I'm giving a talk or doing a community stuff, it's such a pleasure not to give a shit about what's next. It's such a pleasure. Uh-huh. I still take notes and make lists, but I do it just out of respect, uh-huh. Not that I ever look at them.
Today you've heard from two guests who spoke the truth about the tough realities that aging brings, but they spoke with a sense of humor and the kind of optimism it takes to find meaning in this stage of life. This is John Schuster with Stories for the Ages. I want to thank our guests for their great words today. And I want to give special thanks to WOSU Public Media. This is a production of that group. To our manager, Tom Ryland, and to a great studio presence in Eric French, who's put our audio product together. Thanks again, listeners.